Good afternoon. My name is Mark Nelson, and I'm the moderator for the February 14th session. I'd like to remind everybody that lunch is $10, and someone will pick it up from the baskets on the tables. I'd like to thank the University of Lethbridge for distributing the notices and the students of the Lethbridge College Communications Arts Department for recording the audio that that you can find on the SACPA website. The talk will be 25 to 30 minutes long, and we'll have a half hour for lunch. Then at 1 o'clock, we'll have a half hour for questions. Today's speaker is Dr. Malcolm Greenshields from the University of Lethbridge. Malcolm received his education in Saskatchewan in England. Since 1986, he's been a professor in the history department. His research specializes in European history and the history of France and the French Revolution. His book, 600 Years of Reform, Bishops and the French Church, 1190 to 1789, which is also 600 pages, was acknowledged by the American Catholic Historical Association for the most distinguished contribution to the knowledge of history of the Catholic Church. Today's talk will be on Prison American Style, a cautionary tale. Recent adjustments in the American criminal justice policy have created a uniquely large prison population. This reality should be of interest to Canadians concerned with public policy and the justice system. I'd like to ask Malcolm to come up.
It's appropriate on Valentine's Day that I've got out of religion after writing that monster book, and I'm back into crime, which is where I belong. And I did speak to my Valentine this morning. I hope you all did. Not to my Valentine, but... Well, I saw several of you speaking to my Valentine, too. And she said, Malcolm, these people are not students. They don't want to sit through a lecture. She was timing. She was warning me about time. Actually, I'm going to borrow your watch, Mark. Have I? Yeah. Good. So I'll try to be brief, succinct, and numerical. I don't really like numbers. I'm not a big fan of numbers. But sometimes they help a lot. When you deal with contentious issues, numbers do not rise up and get red in the face, poke you in the chest. They're quiet, they sit there. Some numbers poke you a bit, but for the most part, they speak with authority, but with indifferent and quiet authority. And numbers sometimes say surprising things that challenge our most cherished ideals. We even may find out that the good old days were bad, for example, by virtue of numbers. And certainly that's been the case in the study that I've been involved in outside of religion, the study of homicide. Well, as well as telling us bitter truths, such as that we may weigh more than we should or something like that, numbers can allow us to know things that are counterintuitive, particularly. I remember one of the assignments I gave a student last year, I said, well, you know, people are always saying the countryside is so peaceful. It's so nice in the country, and the towns are nasty. And that's been the sort of Western, that's been our Western myth, hasn't it? Country's always nice. And the city's full of painted women and painted men, too, for that matter, and all kinds of allure and all kinds of violence and so on. And yet, this student found, just simply using Statistics Canada, that, in fact, the countryside was usually more violent than the city and than most cities in this country. So numbers tell us surprising things. For the past few years, I have been looking at the history of homicide in what became the rich advanced Western countries, places in Western Europe, in other words, and North America, Canada and the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And the story of homicide in the West, as long as records have permitted us to make some kind of estimate, is the story of a long-term decline, by and large. That's one of the estimates there, cobbled together from an immense amount of work from many different historians, and you can see what's happening. The trend since the 14th or the 15th century has been one long downward trend. It's a long-term decline. There is, however, a bit of a jump in the second half of the 20th century, and nowhere is that jump more remarkable than in the United States. And the United States, in fact, was almost unique in this. We'll go in a little closer now. We'll go from the telescope to the, well, not quite the microscope, but we see something else happening. And the most spectacular exception, then, to the general long-term downward trend in homicide has been in the West, has been the United States. Now, let's not get carried away. The United States is not, in world terms, a particularly violent place. I've often heard people shrilling about how terrible it is. Yes, there are cities in the United States whose rates of violence are frightful, but there are also cities such as New York City now, which are really quite peaceful and quite safe. And you're probably safer in Iowa than you are in Saskatoon. So, I mean, one shouldn't get too carried away with this stuff. But the point is that the United States was an exception, and there the 20th century saw two particular waves of killing. One rose steeply after World War I and peaked during the early 1930s, as you can see, and the other really had several peaks that you can see there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Canada's peak, by the way, was 1975, just so you keep the Canadian perspective on this. So it occurred to me, as it has to many, that these waves rose steeply during two periods of prohibition. The rapid rise in the United States is during the period of the Volstead Act and the prohibition of alcoholic beverages, which ends in the early 30s. And the second one characterizes mainly the period in which there has been a so-called war on drugs. So it's well to remember these things when we start to look at law. When we think of crime, we always think of crime as being something that's universally agreed upon. A crime is a crime before God and man and everyone else. But in point of fact, we often define crime by law. Many things are not crimes until there is law. And we agree internationally on a few things. Usually, we agree that you shouldn't take other people's stuff. That's usually a crime. That's one of them. The other one is that you shouldn't hurt other people or kill them, generally speaking. We usually criminalize most kinds of homicide except for self-defense and police activity and so on. But these are all decisions nonetheless. As soon as we get into something that is not clearly harmful to others, then we have to make a decision. Are we going to criminalize this thing? I'm not on any particular side of many of these issues, so it doesn't much matter to me, but the prohibition of alcohol was a very good example. We could argue, and I don't think many would disagree, even those two-fisted, hard-drinking Albertans out there, that alcohol causes a lot of problems, and that perhaps we would be better off in the society if we didn't have any of it except to clean wounds. Man, we'd have many fewer wounds to clean if we didn't have alcohol. True. Point is that it's a decision. It's a kind of ethical decision, but it's also a decision in social policy. And those decisions in social policy drive many things. We have to make them carefully, and we have to remember that we are making crime by making law in some instances. The one I think of right away, I just finished reading Bill C-2 the other night. I got a copy of it finally, and there was one about a minimum sentence for anyone who knowingly possesses an unauthorized firearm. And I thought, my goodness, if suddenly the police in Alberta were to enforce this law, can you imagine how many of your friends might suddenly become criminals? So you can criminalize just about anything, make a law against it, and suddenly there are all kinds of people on the other side. So that's public policy. That's a policy of criminal justice. It's not simply on universally agreed evils or sins. It's also on other things. Could I have a glass of water there, please? Oh, there it is. I think that's mine there. Thank you. So, in some ways, crime is a decision. Now, there are other waves of homicide you can look at, and it's not one I'm going to debate today, but it's kind of an interesting one. The wave of homicide that is public policy as well in the United States, and don't worry, I knew this was going to happen, but I wouldn't be able to find the right, there it is, here's public policy as well, which is its own wave of homicides. This is public, or this is state executions in the United States. It's a bit hard to see. Perhaps the person was nervous who was making the diagram, may have been done in prison or something. You'll notice in the homicide diagram earlier.
You need the mic.
In the homicide diagram earlier, do I still need the mic? Are you all there?
Yeah.
Good. In the homicide diagram earlier, there was a similar sort of set of waves. But this is a wave that is entirely public policy. This is a wave of executions. And the other caveat that I must give you when talking about the United States, everything you say, certainly regarding criminality, everything must have severe regional qualifications. You can't simply talk about crime or criminal law in the United States because criminal law, for the most part in the U.S., is state law. And so you're dealing with 50 different law codes, basically. You're not dealing with one code as we have in Canada for the most part in criminal law. So there we have an interesting diagram that shows public policy with regard to crime. It's a contentious issue and not one I want to talk about today. It's one that does tend to get faces red and fingers hitting chests. So we'll leave it. It is kind of an interesting oddity I noticed this morning, actually, is that the rate of execution in Texas, the higher end, is exactly the rate of homicide in Canada in the last recorded year. So it's quite an interesting. Texas executes as many people as Canadian murderers kill. Interesting fact. And one which is absolutely of no use to you at all. So, in this talk, but I don't know, it just turned me on somehow, and I thought that you should hear it. So, I've looked at homicide as punishment, and looking at homicide as punishment, I became more interested in the entire universe of punishment in the West, which is part of my study of homicide. So, when Mark came to me to ask me to talk about something, I said, well, I'll talk about what I'm reading right now. Which is what you're going to get. I'm reading about jails, and particularly prisons in the United States. And what we find, despite the fact that there are all kinds of contentious matters such as capital punishment, the greatest contention on which Americans who are expert in the subject agree, and which I think is of use to us as Canadians, is over the prison system itself. In fact, the incarceration of Americans. Because the surprising figure I found when I began to look at this was that the United States was here an exception, not only in the Western world, the industrialized modern democracies, but also in the world in general. And the rates at which we imprison our citizens are a very interesting measure of our countries. The rates at which most of the Western democracies imprison their citizens, they're usually measured per 100,000. And in Canada, for example, we would have roughly 100 to 110 prisoners per 100,000 population. In Britain, it's a little higher. It's more like 130 right now. It goes up and down. Denmark would be in the mid-60s. France is quite low. India is one of the lowest democracies in punishment, only about 30 prisoners per 100,000. So around 100. And until the 1970s, the United States was part of that club. Basically, there are about 250,000 to 300,000 prisoners in the U.S. So that rate was about 100 to 100,000 population. But the worldwide average being 100, something alarming happened in the United States over a period of about 35 years. And it's caused alarm not only among experts, among academics and people like that. They're always alarmed. Academics are always alarmed, I want to warn you. But also among legislators, among those who, in fact, had a hand in creating the situation. And that is that the United States, quite shockingly, in the last 35 years, has become the world's leading jailer. In the United States now, the prison population is thought to be the largest in the world. I take it with a grain of salt because I'm sure there are places in the world we really don't know the entire statistic. But as far as documented prisoners go, the United States has more of them than anyone else, and it imprisons its citizens at a much higher rate than anywhere else in the world. So the rate is now passing about 750 prisoners per 100,000 people. And if you look at the male side, of course, that means close to 1% of the male population. This is an alarming situation for Americans, and I think, as I say in the title of this thing, a cautionary tale for everyone else when we're considering the kinds of measures we often consider in response to criminality, or at least it's usually not in the response to criminality as much as it is in the fear of criminality. We're usually talking about people being afraid rather than knowing, in fact. So 5% of the world has 25% of the world's prisoners. And this is said in many ways. Some people say it's the greatest prison population in history. Well, no, I don't think so. I doubt that. I imagine Hitler's prison populations, considering the Holocaust, were much greater. And Stalin's gulag may not have been as big as the American prison population, but per capita it was probably bigger. So it's probably, people are estimating like 800 per 100,000. So Stalin passes Bush, sort of thing, you know, in prisoners. But and that's not very nice company, really, is it? Not the company you want to keep. But so what's the extent of this problem? What are its effects, and how does it happen? That's the question. On the 4th of October last year, Jim Webb, who was the U.S. Senator from Virginia, conducted a hearing of what was called the Joint Economic Committee of both the House of Representatives and the Senate, the U.S. Congress. The proceedings of the hearing are entitled Mass Incarceration in the U.S., or in the United States, at what cost? The purpose of the hearing was, quote, to explore the steep increase in the U.S. prison population and the economic and social costs of mass incarceration. In Webb's opening statement, you can see right away, his statement betrays both the concern and the frustration of those who have studied this problem and the spectacular recent history of American prisons. Over the course of the period from the 1970s to today, Webb puts it, the United States has embarked upon one of the largest public policy experiments in our history. And you got to kind of admire the chutzpah of the Americans. You know, they go right to it and don't compare themselves to anybody. They're unique, and they act. And that, is many times, is a very admirable quality as well. But this is one of the results. Largest public policy experiments in our history, yet this experiment is shockingly absent from public debate. Have you heard it in the presidential primaries? Has anyone mentioned the prison population in the United States? Not really. They've talked about building schools instead of prisons, but they never quite get into the real thing. Why? Why is that, do you think? You don't want to be soft on crime, right? And the softer you get around the middle, I've found, the harder you get on crime, because the more removed you are from it. At any rate, my Valentine also told me that this morning. At any rate, in the name of getting tough on crime, Jails and prisons, and these are the words of Webb as well, now contain more people than the populations of New Mexico, West Virginia, or several other states. Like other students of prisons, the members of the Joint Economic Committee went on to express the problem in a number of different statistical ways to impress upon the public and its listeners the nature and consequence of such a remarkable experiment in mass imprisonment. Quote, all told, more than 7 million Americans are under some form of correctional supervision, including probation and parole. So one in 32, something like that, I think it works out to. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, a similar number in the population has also served time in state or federal prisons. That is, people alive who at some point have served time in prisons are in the millions, perhaps even up to close to the 10 million. One of every 15 Americans at the present rate will serve time in a prison. People often talk about private prisons. Private prisons aren't that big yet in the States. They're 6% of the prison population. But when you consider that 6%, wow, what a contract, nonetheless. It's a big business. One WAG has even suggested, it was rather interesting, I was reading various things on this problem, and one person even suggested that at the present rate of population increase in the United States and the present rate of prison population increase, by about 150 years, it'd be the 22nd century, all Americans will be in jail. So the problem will be solved. They'll all be guarding each other. But clearly, it's not going to happen. Someone will put a stop to that, surely. Representative Carolyn Maloney emphasized to the Joint Economic Commission the link between education and imprisonment. We see that quite clearly. Education programs in prisons and treatment programs, despite all the cynical things you always hear, oh, nobody can be rehabilitated and so on, actually lower the rate of return to prison. Almost universally, in studies by the U.S. prison system, by the federal government of the United States, this is the case. Recidivism is lowered by education. By all the things that we're told popularly don't work, they do work. But of course, with a system so much under strain, many of the educational programs simply don't exist anymore. They can't exist for such large numbers. Adding to the fact that the 13% of the United States population that is black contributes roughly half the prisoners, Representative Maloney also stated, it has become a sad truth that a black man in his late 20s without a high school diploma is more likely to be in prison than to be working. She was also quick to point out the vast difference in expense between the costs of educational programs, of treatment programs, of all other programs, in fact, and the cost of imprisonment. In Canada, we have a peculiar problem, and that is the problem of fetal alcohol syndrome, which is extremely common in prisons. That's a whole other story that is very difficult to deal with. We also have a disproportion. We needn't be smug about the Americans and their half black prisoners because, for example, 3% of our population is imprisoned for 23% of the homicides in the country. And that's a 3% that is a racial minority, the Aboriginal people. So various experts have pointed out that the punishment of U.S. prisoners doesn't stop at the prison gates. The barriers to successful reentry into society are considerable. And I should give you some shocking statistics because everyone keeps giving them to me. And these are people who try to poke you in the chest by big titles and different colors. Unfortunately, I've muted them down to a suitably Canadian gray, black, and white. So there's a comparison there. You can see the rates of incarceration in other places. Canada doesn't get a mention there, but they're dealing with large countries here, large populations. Here's another one that's very excitable. Who did this one? You still get the idea. This is a little older, but still, here's Canada here. Canada's usually below Britain
above France sort of thing. And you can see... Now, that's the rate. If we were using the raw numbers, of course, the last graph would be hitting the more than hitting the ceiling in comparison to the others. Here's another way of looking at it, like so. And these are almost universally American publications, so that we're not talking about something that's a secret or that's debated or anything like that. These are things that exist in the here and now. Those are awfully small countries there, small names, aren't they? If you can see those, you don't need to be here. You are some kind of super person. But you can see it starts with Nepal up there and comes down to the United States here. And the rich Western world basically starts about here. The countries that I mean are comparable to the United States and Canada. And those are, I think, the countries. You can brag all you want about not having as many people murdered as Colombia or something, but the point is that we should look at comparable things, I think.
What are the others right at the bottom next to the U.S.?
The very bottom is the Russian Federation, which, of course, has a huge crime problem as well as a huge imprisonment problem. Cuba, the Ukraine, Singapore, Botswana, South Africa. Actually, South Africa is much worse than that. Than since that was taken. So South Africa is probably down there somewhere. But once you... the other place that's interesting is the West Indies. You may think of the West Indies as peaceful and, you know, hula dancing. No, that's Hawaii, isn't it? At any rate, you may think of them that way, but actually the West Indies has a very serious problem with violent crime. And so they're also a big imprisoner. Let's look at it as an industry. Let's look at it as an investment. Because one of the biggest industries, it's a very good investment, you see. Those are the prisons built in California since 1984. Since 1984. So we're talking what? 20 years? 23 years? Something like that? And they're already too full. So it does set you back on your heels. It certainly did me. And I'll only be back on my heels for a couple more minutes. I don't know exactly how much time I have. 5 minutes or so. Okay. The consequences of this are immense. First of all, we've got to remember that most of the rise is not due to violence. These aren't violent felons. Most of the felons are nonviolent felons, or at least arrested for nonviolent crimes. In this case of the United States, the war on drugs, particularly important in this. And various experts have also pointed out that imprisonment or punishment doesn't stop at the prison gates. There's also the invisible punishment of prisoners. In all but about 15 states, usually felons can't vote. So right away you're cut off from being an active citizen once you've got a prison record. Some states you can never vote, others you can apply, and so on. A bunch of different rules. Public assistance is usually unavailable. Public housing is usually unavailable. Employment is very difficult to get. Student loans are often unavailable. And even admission into some colleges is not allowed if you have a criminal record, especially a felony record. So, what are your choices when you get out? What's the most likely choice? It's the thing you learned, both in prison, probably mostly in prison, because you didn't learn much outside prison. If you were arrested for drug possession, for example, you simply were in the wrong place. So, because the numbers are so great, these problems become huge. When you have millions of people coming out of prison, you're creating a different kind of society. And if you have a community like the black community in the United States, where prison becomes normalized, prison becomes a normal rite of passage for a lot of young men. In fact, probably about a 60% chance now for a young man who doesn't complete school to go to prison. What does that make? The stigma is gone. I mean, there's no stigma to prison then. In fact, there may even be a positive one. You even have a culture, right, a rap culture. And you'll remember, and the first rappers always wore those pants that were too big for them. Now, where do you get pants that are too big for you? Usually in jail. And it was a jail culture to some extent that was being expressed there, and has become a very popular culture. So it becomes a cultural norm with vast effects. And young black men currently are more likely to go to prison than they are to go to a college or university or even into the U.S. military. So that's become a path created by this prison glut. And the situation now for African Americans is worse than in the worst Jim Crow days of segregation legislation and all that kind of thing that the civil rights movement fought against. So it's a big business now, one in which perhaps Canadians should invest, I don't know. How did it get this way is the question. Very quickly, that's perhaps where history is most instructive to us. For 34 years, almost 35 now, there has been a steady incremental increase every year in the American prison population, without fail. 34 years. How did it happen? It happened in several ways. One was the get tough politics. Get tough politics are fine. Everyone believes we should be tough on crime. I agree with it. Why not? But when you get tough, you always have to be tougher next year than you were last year. And your opponent is always going to say that he or she is just as tough, if not tougher. So you get a sort of get tough dialectic going on over the years. And really, the incarceration rate in the United States has been guided mostly by political considerations rather than by rates of criminality, which have not varied as much as one would expect. In fact, when the rate of possession of marijuana arrests went down, prison still kept going up. When the rate of violence went down, as it's gone down quite dramatically recently, prison population still rises in those years when it's been very, very low. So it's driven by something else. And we are rational human beings, especially people who come to events like this. We consider policy rationally. In the 18th century, poor old Cesare Beccaria started the deterrent argument that if sentences were sure and swift, then criminals, being rational hedonists, which all humans are, he thought, then they would avoid crime. They would pursue pleasure instead. Problem is, how many times have you been held up by a rational hedonist, I ask myself? How many times do they shout at you in the street? Those rational hedonists are not very dangerous, generally. So I don't think Beccaria was quite right. I don't think that people calculate before they kill someone. Usually it's some kind of terrible fight or something like that. Ask the police, what are most murders but fights? So the deterrent value is sometimes even lost by the length of prison sentences. There is a study that suggests longer sentences produce more recidivism, in fact, rather than less, especially for first-time offenders. So when we think of the things that cause this American prison glut, they are the war on drugs, declared by Richard Nixon and pursued particularly vigorously by the current administration. They are mandatory minimum sentences. They are longer sentences. They are denial of parole and more frequently. That's always one of the tough guy slogans, get rid of parole, right? That sounds great, but it leads to other things. And these things were done in a political get tough campaign. Everyone was tougher than everyone else, and suddenly we see the problem. So we have to think of what solves crime, not what wins elections. And we have to think about it very carefully as Canadians. I think I'll close with Winston Churchill. Everyone should close with Winston. If I can find him here. And that'll be enough. I think I've gone over my limit. I see Mark frantically giving me the two fingers and the three fingers. And I'm not sure what he means. It's the one finger I'm really scared of. But I'll give it to you. I'll give you a paraphrase. A civilization is most clearly judged by its public attitudes and public treatment of what they call crime and criminals. And he wasn't talking about getting tougher. And he was pretty tough. So thank you very much, and I'll welcome any questions as soon as I've had a drink.